This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn, love, listen, live. With your hosts, Tama Fulton and John Hudson Masserol. Are you ready to discover your True North Story?
Popular. I'll help you be popular. You'll hang with the right cohorts. You'll be good at sports. Know the slang you've got to know. So let's start, because you've got an awfully long way to go.
Hello?
Bob Glauberman, please.
This is Bob Glauberman.
Are we sure it's Bob Glauberman?
What's going on?
I am so happy to talk to you. You have no idea.
Last time I talked to you, I was singing with you.
We were.
Yeah.
Wow.
We were. This is my podcast co-host, John Masserol, Bob Glauberman.
Hello, John.
Hello, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Doing well, thank you very much. I'm doing much better now that Tama and I are able to talk to you on True North Story.
Excellent, as am I.
The Bob I remember always loved singing in the stage and all of that. But the Bob that left high school and went into college didn't really study that.
No, not at all.
That's the whole premise of our podcast, True North Story, is to help people figure out what it is that brings them passion and joy in life. And sometimes we end up on one trajectory and we have to make U-turns or take some other circuitous route to get there. And you are one of those people. Tell me what happened when you left high school.
It's so funny because, and by the way, it's so great to reconnect with you after all this time.
You're one of my favorite people ever, just so you know.
Oh, right back at you. I feel totally feel the same way. I was running a race, and I'll talk about what those races mean in a second. And a woman, I briefly told my story, and this woman came up to me who was a lawyer, and she said, "I'm a lawyer, and I hate my life, and I want to do what you did." It's so funny that that happened yesterday. Now, 24 hours later, we're having the same conversation. I left high school. I was always pressured to succeed. This is not a rag session on my parents. It has to do with myself.
Yeah.
It has to do with what we value as a society. But I got very good grades in elementary school. I got very good grades in high school. I was valedictorian of the high school that I went to, Central High School, and I went to Stanford University to achieve. That was my goal, to achieve and to become a doctor or a lawyer, and got very good grades at Stanford, and my main focus was to get good grades, to get a job, be either a doctor or a lawyer, pull down the six-figure-plus salary, and become rich. I got into UCLA Law School, came down to UCLA, got good grades at UCLA Law School, got a job at a New York law firm, White & Case. White & Case was the paid the most out of all of these other law firms. So I won.
Wow.
I became a lawyer. And I won the highest salary out of all of these other law firms. And I practiced as a lawyer for 2 years, and I hated my life. And I remember very distinctly looking out over the landscape of the skyline of Los Angeles from my building in downtown Los Angeles as a lawyer at 2 a.m. And I realized, I hate this life. I hate this. I hate my life. In 7 years, if I stick with this, I'm going to be a partner. And I go into these partners' offices, and I see they've got all these little deal toys on their desk. You know what a deal toy is?
What?
A deal toy is a little plastic monument, kind of like the monolith from 2001. It's got it has a little sheet of the very first page of a deal memo that you've created, a deal that you've closed. And these partners had their desks littered with these deal toys. And the more deal toys you had, the more successful a partner you were. And I just didn't want to be that. 7 years down the road, I did not want, there was no good road for me. So I quit the law. I took an $85,000 pay cut, and I decided to try and do something that I enjoyed. And I wrote out a list. I started reading books like What Color Is My Parachute? Started The Artist's Way. I tried doing a bunch of different things. I wrote a list of all the things that I could do that I wanted to do. And one of them was acting, what you and I did back in elementary school. One of them was being a voiceover artist. One of them was being a stand-up. One of them was doing these very intricate brain-teasing treasure hunts that I did in college. I remember that I had so much fun doing that. And it took a while, but I started systematically trying all of these things to see which things that I liked. The things that I gravitated towards were the acting and this treasure hunt experience. And I started a company while I was acting. I did both things at the same time. I also wanted to be a film critic. I got a job as a film critic for a paper called the Los Angeles Village View. But I didn't enjoy that. I only focusing on the things that I enjoyed. So I started running these treasure hunts for friends. I met up with this guy who said, you know, you're running these treasure hunts for friends. That's great. Why not create a business? We created a business called Fantastic Race. He had some connections in Mexico with the cruise lines, with Carnival Cruise Lines. Flew down to Mexico, toured Cozumel, Mexico, created a treasure hunt down there, hooked up with Carnival Cruise Lines, started that as a business, flew back to Los Angeles, created some courses here in Los Angeles. Now we've expanded. We're a company now that has races in Los Angeles, Santa Monica, Mexico, Hawaii, Australia, Texas, and we do custom races as well. I'm an actor now. I got an agent. If you IMDb me, I'm approaching 100 entries, acting with Alicia Silverstone in a show called American Woman. I've got a voiceover agent. I'm doing some voiceover. Stand-up was never really my bag, but I tried it. I tried being a film critic. That didn't work for me, and certainly I didn't want anything having to do with the law. Perhaps I'm in a trough when it comes to acting. And so I focus on the escape room part. And the escape room part, there aren't a lot of bookings, and now Mexico picks up. So it's a scary life. It's unlike being a lawyer, because as a lawyer, you always know where your next paycheck is coming from. You know, you have a steady job. This is not a steady job. This is a scary life. And I have a daughter in private school. She's 14. I have a house. I have a mortgage. It's a scary life, but it's a thrilling. When I was a lawyer, I felt like I was dead. And now I feel like I'm alive. I always had a flair for the dramatic, and I always envisioned being a lawyer was like being like Tom Cruise in The Usual Suspects, you know? Right. Jack Nicholson to break down on the stand. You can't handle the truth. Nothing like that. It's nothing like that. It's boring. Oh, it's so awful. I can't, and I apologize to any attorneys who are listening, but it's the worst job. It's like it's being in a library and trying to decide the difference between subsection 2 of code 136 and subsection 3 of a different code section. It's like I'd almost want to be a stripper rather than being an attorney, you know, if someone would have me. So, and some people love it. So my daughter, she was like 9 or 10, she saw Legally Blonde, and she, for a brief moment, she said, I want to go to law school, and my heart sank. And I went, no, don't be a lawyer. Here, be an actor. Be an artist. The opposite, the complete opposite of, I have a very strange perspective, I guess.
No, it sounds like it's very opposite of the way you were raised yourself.
Absolutely right.
Tell us a little bit about that.
My dad was a doctor, so he was professional. My mom was a teacher. We grew up in Phoenix, upper middle class. Tama and I went to Madison Meadows, which is upper middle class public elementary school. We were not rich. We were comfortable. I come from a Jewish family. We're a Holocaust family. So my grandparents came to this country in the 40s. So that would make my parents second generation. With a lot of second generation Americans, the goal is to, or immigrants, I should say, the goal is to achieve. Oh my God, we suffered through, my grandparents suffered through this horrible tragedy in Germany. We want to make sure that our children are taken care of. So with parents, this isn't a rag session on my parents, because I remember being so happy that I was smart. I remember being so happy that I could get good grades, and I thought when I was going through in eighth grade, I won the smartest, the most intelligent or the smartest kid at Madison Meadows at eighth grade, and I got a trophy for that. And I remember feeling, wow, this feels good. You know, and I would get stickers when I would get good grades. I would get stickers for that. I would go through high school valedictorian. Like I said, I would win all these awards and all these prizes. I got into Stanford, and it's like, I'm the can you curse on this or not?
Sure.
Yeah, I'm the shit. I'm so great. I'm you know, and I'm better than this guy, and I'm better than this guy. It was all about being better than these people. And it felt great. It's a shitty way to grow up, because you're in competition with everyone. And so you're kind of, it's not enough that you succeed. Everyone else has to fail. And it felt bad. It felt bad. It felt good when I would, you know, when I would get 100% on the test, but I had to maintain that. And when I was at Stanford, it's impossible to be the best at Stanford. And I would feel, I got very good grades at Stanford, you know. I'm not.
Yeah, the level of competition.
It's a top tier school. There are so many brilliant people there. I wasn't even close to being the smartest there, and that hurt. Everyone was smarter than me. If I wasn't first, I might as well be last, and that's the worst way to go through life. And interestingly, it's so funny. I had the same conversation with my wife and daughter this morning, because I did not want my daughter to grow up the way that I grew up. And so we are sending her to progressive schools, which have no or limited grades, few or limited tests, limited homework. I've read all the books of this guy named Alfie Kohn, Kohn. If you're familiar, are you familiar with this guy?
I am not. Tell me.
Alfie Kohn, he's so great. It's like a revelation when I read this book. It's called, and if I'm talking too much, interrupt me, please. It's called.
We try. It doesn't work.
No, you just keep going. No, that's okay.
I will stop talking whenever you say. I just have so much to say, and I love this topic. Punished by Rewards. Punished by Rewards by Alfie Kohn. And the radical thesis of this book is that when you're raising a child, all punishments, or in any situation, all punishments are bad. Across the board, all punishments are bad. All, like, corporal punishment is bad, spanking is bad, okay? That might be not so radical. But the corollary to that, the other side of the coin, is that all rewards are bad too, and that includes praise. So all gold stars are bad. All monetary incentives are bad. And by the way, for punishments, that includes timeouts. Timeouts are bad, too. All incentives are bad, too. Praise is bad. Saying good job, good boy, good girl to your daughter or son, that's all bad, too. And the reason for that, this is a very, very radical, it's counterintuitive. It goes completely against the way that I was raised. It goes completely against this whole achievement culture in this society. It goes against the entire Republican platform, you can guess what political party I believe in. Additionally, it creates praise junkies. And a praise junkie is someone who winds up just chasing the praise, and they wind up in a law firm making a whole lot of money and completely miserable. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. So I had my midlife crisis at age 25 when I tried to find what I was interested in. So the radical view of Alfie Kohn is don't punish your kid, don't reward your kid, don't praise your kid. There should be no external judgment of any kind from the parent. Instead, what this does is it grows intrinsic value from within, and there are all sorts of so when you're parenting your kid in this philosophy, the job is to be like a color commentator, play-by-play announcer for like Al Michaels on Monday Night Football. So if
right.
they come home with a crayon drawing or a finger painting, and they say, "Daddy, Mommy, what do you think of this finger painting?" You must not say, "Oh my God, that's beautiful, Lexi. That is so you're an amazing artist. This is so wonderful. I'm so proud of you. This is great." You don't do that in the philosophy of Alfie Kohn. Instead, you say, tell me about this painting. I see that you've used a lot of colors.
Mm-hmm.
I see that there's some blue up here. I see that there's some red here. Tell me about it. And any sort of judgment goes out the window.
Right.
And this is the philosophy that that I adhere to now as a parent. My wife does as well. And we've created a daughter who just this morning, we were talking about colleges now. And we were talking because she wants to be a vet. And she says that she doesn't want to, she's not interested in going to a quote-unquote good college. That's not where her interest lies. She wants to find a program where she, which has a pre-vet program, which can then put her in good stead to go into a veterinarian graduate program. But it's not, she's not interested in a prestigious program. And we just had that conversation this morning. So,
how much this pressure to achieve and to, once you got to Stanford, feeling like, why even try? I'm not top of the class. How much of that was inside of Bob?
It's a really good question. On the one hand, I saw that my dad was a doctor, and I saw that that was good. I saw that he made a lot of money, and that was good. And when people would say, what does little Bobby want to be when he grows up? Either they said jokingly, you know, they would say, oh, he wants to be a doctor. Or perhaps I then said, repeated that, I want to be a doctor. That was my thing. That was the answer to that question. And that got a good response. Could have been something that I internalized, just looking around, seeing my dad was a doctor, seeing that I would get praise and I would get strokes whenever I got really good grades. But I felt the pressure within me. Every test was like, I haven't seen Hamilton, but it's kind of like when Hamilton and Aaron Burr, you know, it was like a duel. Mm-hmm. Every test was a duel. I had to be the best in class, in the class. No one could take me down. And that was a shitload of pressure for any kid to put on himself. And I put that on myself all through elementary school, all through high school, all through college, scrambling. I was scrambling because I knew I desperately wanted to be the best, but I couldn't. So I was not punished. If anything, I was not punished by my parents if I did not get – I never got bad grades, ever. So there was no reason to punish me. It was carrot, not stick. When I got good grades, I was rewarded. I was, oh, my God, you're great. You know, I was praised. And that felt so good. And I had to – I've also done a lot of therapy. And so I knew – and so one thing that is in me – that's where I perceive that my value lies, my brain. You remember, Tama, I'm a very short guy, And
I was very tall.
She still is.
We all have our scars. My value was not my looks, and it certainly wasn't my athletics. So my value was my brain. And so if I had to be the best, because if I wasn't the straight-A student, I was nothing. I was absolutely nothing. I was shit. And that's a place that I had to, and I still struggle with that. I still struggle with not be, I fight on Facebook. I'm constantly fighting on Facebook. Each fight on Facebook, I have to win that fight on Facebook. If I don't win that fight on Facebook, I'm nothing. It's the same thing. So I've, in a lot of ways, I've kind of broke free of that mold, but I've substituted Facebook for grades now, or money. I'm not interested in comparing myself to how much money I make versus how much money someone else makes. I'm not doing that anymore. I used to. Now I've substituted Facebook. And so when I'm fighting on Facebook, and I get really brutal at times, I fight to the death. If I don't win, I'm nothing. It's funny. It's kind of tragic, too.
Well,
but that's where that fight comes from.
What's really interesting to me about that is that everything that you're talking about, Bob, is all competitive. Whether it be the grades, whether it be law school, whether it's getting hired by the law firm at the end, it's all competitive. Acting. Oh, my gosh. You are going in and you are auditioning. In your case, probably fewer people because you have a reputation. You have a body of work. So they know when they're calling you in more of what they're getting than opposed to a cattle call where you might have 100 people rolling through the audition studio. But that's competitive, too. I mean, my God, Hollywood and the entertainment business is one of the most competitive businesses in the world. So what it sounds like from the Facebook part is you're just trying to control that part, which is the dialogue in that conversation.
Right.
Because you can't control the other stuff.
Right.
as much.
You know, it is something that I enjoy. You're absolutely right. I'm going through a job interview. So you are absolutely 100% right that is something that I am repeating the pattern, but I think the difference is I am competing against other people. I'm not taking it as personally.
Right.
I don't have to be better than this person. It is more arbitrary. They're picking one person rather than rejecting 10. There's too many
right.
people. It's too arbitrary. It's not possible for me to take it personally, because if I do, then I'm done.
Any actor, if you take that personally as an affront to you every time you don't book a gig,
I couldn't do it.
No, you jump off a cliff somewhere.
Yes, exactly. Exactly right.
Well, Bob, tell us a little bit about getting started in the acting world. I know that for a lot of actors, they started out as game show contestants.
Yes.
Was that a foray for you?
Correct. I've also been on a lot of game shows. By last count, I think it's 9 or 10. I've been on 10 game shows. I've won over $1 million on these various game shows. And that didn't hurt in an insecure field. That went a long way to allaying the fears of my wife. So, so I remember on one particular game show where I won a lot of money. On one game show, I won $890,000.
And
at the end of the game show, I went to my wife and I said, "Okay, Steph, now we don't have to fight about money for a while."
And, oh, that's great. Can you say what game show it was?
I can't.
You can't.
And the reason I can't is one of the beautiful things about living in Los Angeles is that there are tons and tons of game shows that don't make the air. There are game show casting directors, just as there are casting directors for actors and voiceover people and stuff like that. So I audition for a lot of game shows that you might not recognize and do not make the air. One particular game show, I'm contractually forbidden to say what game show this is, because it's a game show that did not make the air, and yet they still had to pay me. I'm forbidden to say what game show it is, but I will say that there are so many game shows that people win money on, and you've never heard of these game shows. There's a lot of winners.
Is that because they are making several episodes in hopes that it will be on the air at some point?
Correct.
Yeah, correct.
Okay, sure.
That's right. And sometimes a game show will be canceled in the middle of a run, and they have to pay those people too. It depends on the fine print of the contract. So being a contract lawyer, I've read these contracts very thoroughly.
I'm sure you have.
I bet
and,
you have.
A lot of them, and so a lot of them have these clauses which might be unconscionable, and so they might not be able to be enforced anyhow, but this one particular contract said, if I had to sign a non-disclosure agreement, it says if you release the name of this, you have to pay $5 million.
Oh my goodness.
I don't have $5 million, but they probably couldn't enforce that anyhow.
Learn, love, listen, live. This is True North Story, the original podcast series. And now back to the program.
If we go back, you have been a character actor, if I can say that, for goodness knows, years and years on lots of different television series that we have known and loved. Where did your first airing start? Was it Ally McBeal? Where were you first?
No, it wasn't. It was a show called Flying Blind. I was still in law school at the time, so I hated law school so much that I was, at the same time I was exploring the law, I was dabbling in these things even during law school. And also, I was kind of a ham during law school. I know that seems shocking. So in 1990, Governor Pete Wilson vetoed some gay rights bill, and a bunch of people protested, this being California, and started throwing stuff at him. So they set up an open mic in the court, and this was at UCLA. Pete Wilson came to speak at UCLA, and people started throwing stuff at him. So they set up an open mic in the courtyard when I was a 1L for that's the first year of law school, for people to air their grievances and to talk about pros and cons of the issue. I was not so politically active at the time, so I went up, I grabbed the microphone, and I started singing my way. A guy from public access television, way back in the day before YouTube, there was a phenomenon known as public access.
Right.
The plot of Wayne's World is based on public access.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I went up, this guy came up to me and said, "That was really funny. Come on my public access show." So I went on his public access show. I did some stand-up. At the time, I was clerking for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and I got a phone call a week later. I picked up the phone, Judge Hall's chambers, and the woman on the other end said, "Hi, Bob. My name is Allison Jones. I'm a casting director. I saw you on this public access show. I thought it was really funny, and I'd like you to come in and read for this pilot that I've got." And I said, "Yeah, right," and hung up on her. And
oh, my goodness.
She called back about a minute later and says, "We got disconnected." And I said, "Yeah, we got disconnected. I hung up on you. You're a casting director." And she says, "Yeah, I'm a casting director. And you want me to come in for a pilot?" She says, "Yeah. And your name is Allison Jones." "Yeah, Jones. Last name is Jones." "All right, Ms. Jones. If you're a casting director, then you must have... you must be at some studio. What's the studio you work for?" People played a lot of practical jokes on me, so I didn't really believe that this was occurring. So she said, "I work at Sunset Gower Studios." I said, "All right, I'm going to call Sunset Gower Studios and see if there's an Allison Jones." I hang up. I call Sunset Gower Studios. I ask for Allison Jones. Here she is. She faxes me the sides, which are the parts that you would read for.
Yeah.
I went in for an audition. I didn't get that audition. But I did get another part for a show called Flying Blind, and I booked it while I was a third year in law school, and I loved it. I loved the experience. And in the next 2 years, at the same time while I was working as a lawyer, I would also be on various shows. I was on Murphy Brown through a series of misadventures caused me to meet my wife. I was on a show called The Wayans Brothers. I was on...
Oh, yeah.
A show called Family Matters and Monty, and you can't be a lawyer at the same time when you're working 5 days on a television show. So I would get really sick and call. I would call Human Resources.
Yeah.
I would call you. Thank you. I would call Human Resources, and I would say, "I'm so sick. I've got food poisoning." Got very, very sick over my first 2 years on all of these various shows. And then Ally McBeal came in 97, I think. That was my biggest thing for a while. And then I started booking commercials, and I quickly learned that there are co-stars, guest stars, recurring, and being a regular on a television show. Co-stars, you can have one line and you're a co-star. A guest star, that you're top of show, you get a little credit at the very top of the show. That's really, really good. A recurring is when you did a guest star and then you come back. A recurring character are the characters like Putty on Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, everyone wants to be a regular because that's on television. That's like Kramer or Jerry. That's when you're the lead on the show.
Right.
So those are all the... Mostly I was co-stars and guest stars. I've done some... I've gotten a lot of recurrings in recently on The League.
We know you were on Bosch. We know that much because...
Yes, I was on Bosch. That's right. That's right.
How about
I was
that?
Just on Bosch, and that was a lot of fun. I usually play the scientist, the nerd. I've played the bad blind date 5 times.
Wow.
5 times. But I love
Starting
it.
To get
I love
complex.
It. And recently, the part I'm going in for tomorrow and the part I was just on NCIS LA, it's the same part. It's the part of the smug, elitist guy who's an asshole who knows what he's talking about. And then the main character, in this case, it's Alicia Silverstone. And in the... Oh, how funny. So Alicia Silverstone was Batgirl, and Chris O'Donnell was Robin. In Batman and Robin. Chris O'Donnell was on NCIS LA. He was taking me to task on NCIS LA, and now she's taking me to task. So I had Robin tearing me a new one, and I've got Batgirl tearing me a new one tomorrow.
That's the whole funny. Damn thing is incestuous, Bob. It's all.
That's
it's
right,
like,
exactly.
It's, you know
exactly.
what I mean? It's like it all comes back around. Everything is all connected. Well, and I did want to just touch on that a little bit. It's funny because Tama's, done a lot of acting. I've done some acting. obviously you're very successful at acting, but it's funny how it seems like you get on little runs. Have you noticed that? And then,
yes.
So you nail something and they're like, everybody wants Bob. And then everybody wants Bob in that similar role. It's
right.
Like, oh my God, don't I ever get to do something else a little bit different, but you know, it's paying the bills and you get a lot more bookings when you're in that, you know, when that's happening, it seems like.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Yeah, totally right. But I like it, though. I like it. If this is about typecasting, I love it. When I was the bad blind date, you know, five times, I was the bad blind date for Calista Flockhart and Ally McBeal,
right.
And for Jenny McCarthy in a movie called Dirty Love, and Carmen Electra, and a woman on a show called The Division, and then so like five different times, these five beautiful women would open the door, and it's me, and they go, "Oh no!" and but I love it. I think it's hilarious, and it's so funny because those are some issues that when I was in high school or in college, being the bad blind date, being seen as the bad blind date would be, believe me, it's come up.
Right.
I know it's a shocker, but it's but it's come up. But and it's something that would have caused me a lot of pain back then. But now I love it. There's a feeling of power that this is how I'm making a living now by, you know, using this what would normally hurt me back in the day, and now I've sort of reclaimed my power over it. And when I go into auditions, I'm often the bald. You know, I often see a casting couch filled with short bald guys, and instead of going, "Oh no, I must be short and bald," because look, it's a casting couch filled of short bald guys. Instead, I claim some sort of pride and even some competition. I go,
right.
"Wait a second. That guy's balder than me. Wait a second. That guy's shorter than me. Wait, oh no, they got a little person. How am I going to be shorter than that guy?" You know? And in a way,
oh, it's awesome.
In a way, the competition has taken on this strange, you know,
it's kind of morphed.
At the, you know, "Oh, he's funnier looking than I am. He's got a bigger nose than I do. Oh no, yeah. He's got a unibrow. How am I going to compete with that?"
Right.
So it's a...
It's the stuff you gotta tell yourself.
Quality to it.
Absolutely. It's a stuff like Tam and I were talking about that. It is like, you know, one of the things that I loved about the film La La Land that I actually saw, and besides the music, and it was just it was an excellent production. I loved the way they portrayed the audition. You know, for anyone who's been an actor, when she goes in and she has this amazing the phone call and she's really into it and she's crying and you know, and what the casting director's like, "Sandwich, she's taking a phone call," and they're doing all
yeah,
this stuff.
Right.
Right. And I'm like, anyone who's ever been an actor sitting in that theater knows exactly what that's like because you are
100%.
Yes.
100%.
You know what I mean? So
yeah.
You got to tell those things
to
yourself.
It was like, it's close to what the last question you asked me about taking it personally. You can't take it personally because they're eating a sandwich. They're concerned about, they've seen 10,000 people.
Right.
They're going
exactly.
to see 10,000 more. It's impossible to take it personally. It's impossible to think that one person is better than you. One person, it's just too arbitrary.
Exactly.
So, and by the way, the fact that that Emma Stone finally gets it, finally becomes famous at the end of La La Land has less to do with her talent as an actress and more to do with how lucky she got that she just happened to
right.
do this thing that 10 people saw in Los Angeles. One of them happened to be a casting director. That's
and isn't
that's
that
just
kind
the way it
of,
works.
Exactly.
And so again, when in the past, when I was getting good grades in and comparing myself to other people, and I would say I'm better than this person, I'm worse than other people, I was basing that on something that was under my control. But with acting, you can't, because it's never under your control. It's never in your control. My God, Daniel Day-Lewis, who, by the way, is quitting acting.
I read that. I read that.
Which is sad. But Daniel Day-Lewis, he wins the Best Actor Award for There Will Be Blood, and one of the things he says is... He gets really neurotic and wonders if he's when he's doing a role. I think he even said he's auditioning. And who would audition Daniel Day-Lewis? You know, but he said he gets neurotic and he wonders if he's a good actor. And this is Daniel Day-Lewis.
Right.
And if Daniel Day-Lewis has these neurotic thoughts about being an actor, then what? You know,
exactly.
Then it's something that's endemic to the profession as a whole. You can't take it personally. These are the masters of the craft who are wondering if they're any good.
Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, Tam and I talk about it. I mean, to make yourself vulnerable, the way that you must do. I mean,
yeah.
To find the truth in the role and then to convincingly portray that in a way that. That the audience can engage with in some meaningful way. That takes a special person, a special individual, a special personality to be able to do that.
I agree. Yeah, and it's not for the weak. It's not for the you have to love it. And a lot of people they say that Los Angeles is the city of broken dreams.
Right.
And this I know so many people. I've been acting for 20 years. Okay, if we count 93 being the first part I was ever on, Flying Blind, I've been an actor for 24 years. And there are so many actors that have fallen by the wayside. And I always tell people, the second it stops being fun, the second that it stops being a thrill, that's when you have to leave. And, you know, I all actors have peaks, have troughs and have valleys and peaks in their career. It's like a roller coaster, and I just broke a little slump that I had with this part that I'm going to be filming tomorrow, and it's a thrill when I get that phone call or that email from my agent and I find out that I booked this thing. I'm going to be working with Alicia Silverstone. I mean, how exciting is that? It's so
right.
Great, and
oh,
I'm so happy. I'm collecting on my DVR every time I'm on TV, Bosch and NCIS LA, sometimes I'm on game shows. Every time I collect an appearance, it's on my DVR, and, you know, I put the little save until I delete thing on it, and that is so much more valuable to me than any deal toy. That's my deal toy.
Right.
Those are my deal toys that I have on my desk. Now, they pay much more frugally than if I was
an
partner
attorney.
At
right.
White & Case right now, but
yeah.
I would not trade that for the world. I'm so proud of what's on my DVR. It's such a thrill for me, and I tell people that who want to be actors that it's a really difficult, scary way to live, but it's exciting and thrilling. And if you live your life, if it's the sum of your choices, this could be the best choice I ever made, with the exception of, you know, marrying my wife and having my daughter. With that, as far as myself personally, it's the best, most defining decision I ever made the day I decided to leave the law firm.
Wow. That's powerful, Bob.
Sure.
Absolutely. Hey, before we wrap up with you, just tell us a little bit about LARF. Is that okay if
sure.
I call it that?
Sure. Yeah. So
okay.
It started off as LARF. LARF stands for the Los Angeles Race Fantastic. We call it Fantastic Race right now. So go to fantasticrace.com. But we have treasure hunts all over. So LARF is a company that encompasses a whole bunch of different treasure hunts, escape rooms, mostly in Los Angeles. But as I said at the top of the hour, we do it also in Australia and in Hawaii and in Mexico. And it's a treasure hunt, but it's a different kind of treasure hunt where you don't know what's coming next. And the clue could take a variety of different forms. We have races at Disneyland where you solve a very difficult clue. You get to Goofy's Bounce House in Toontown, and you're looking around for the clue, you and your team of four people, and you're going, And by the way, people pay about $45, $50 to play this game. And the game lasts about 4 hours. So you're running around Disneyland, or you're running around Mexico, or you're running around Australia or Hawaii looking for clues, trying to get to the finish line. It's a more puzzly version of The Amazing Race. So back to Disneyland, you're in Toontown, and you're looking around, and you're trying to find the clue, and there's no clue there. Meanwhile, a little 8-year-old girl comes up to you crying, and she says, "I lost my mommy. I can't find my mommy. Please help me find my mommy." And most people do not help the little girl. 80% of people do not help the little girl. They're too on task. They will say something like, "Okay, I'll help you in 1 second," or "I'm going to take you to the park employee, but I can't help you right now. I'm busy." And if you don't help the little girl, you don't get the clue. She's an actress. If you help her and you say, "Okay, I'll help you. What did your mommy look like?" She goes, "My mommy, she had a blue dress on and a red hat. And sitting on the bench about 10 feet away is a woman with a blue dress and a red hat." You go, "Is that your mommy?" And she goes, "Oh, my God, mommy. Oh, my God, Lexi, there you are. There you are. Thank you so much. Thank you so much." And she gives you the clue. So that's the kind of thing that we're doing, where we're messing with you. There's some immersive theater going on. You don't know what shape the clue will take, and it's sort of an alternate reality. It's a very unique game that adults play. We've had celebrities play it, and the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, actually.
Yes, they did. Yes.
We had a whole episode.
You were in there, too, Bob. I saw you.
I was in there, right. Yeah, me and my partner, Larry.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, explaining the rules of the game. I loved it.
Who won?
It was Yolanda lost, but I think it was Brandy and Kyle Richards. They split into like three teams, and it was the team of Brandy and Kyle Richards that won.
Wow.
But we didn't get to see the entire race on the show.
No, and it was actually much more clever than what they put on the show. But of course, this being reality television, it's all fake. I don't want to spoil anybody's party.
Spoiler alert for True North Story fans: reality television is not real.
No, it's fake. It's fake. Sorry, guys.
But I just wanted to say just quickly, Bob. I mean, it's amazing what you've been able to do and the career you've been able to put together and the roles and just being able to stay in it as long as you have, and I think that's encouraging to our audience too, because one of the things Tam and I try and do with True North Story is just to provide inspiration and encouragement, motivation and hope, all four of them, but, you know, through the guests that we have on the show. And, you know, acting as a profession is a grind. It's scary, to your point. It's hard. It's very rewarding, but, you know, at the same time, there are high highs and there are low lows. And so, so I just wanted to thank you and appreciate you sharing your insights, because there are people who will listen to this that are aspiring actors or are currently working in that field that maybe need some encouragement and inspiration.
Well, thank you for having me. I mean, this is I'm so down with your philosophy and what you guys are doing on the show. And if what I said helped, I'm so glad. I love talking about this stuff, and I think that this is a way to take power over your life and to create meaningful lives. We only go around this crazy planet once, and I think we should make the best of it.
Absolutely. So people want to know more about Bob Glauberman. Where do they go?
Oh, so you should go to learn about my company. Go to fantasticrace.com. And if you want to follow me as to what's going on with my career, go to you can IMDb me by going to www.imdb.com. That's the Internet Movie Database. And plug in Bob Glauberman, Glauberman. Or if you're a casting director, go to www.nowcasting.com/Bob Glauberman, because, hey, I'm for hire.
There you go.
Awesome, Bob. Thank you for sharing your True North story with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. And oh, my God, it's so great to reconnect with you, Tama.
Just love you, Bob. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Thanks,
Bob.
Talk
to you soon. Bye-bye.
But through it all.
Thank you for listening to True North Story, the series. Follow us on Twitter @True North Story. And tune in next time for another True North story.